Hey, it's Greg. This is the Square Pizza Pod, cooked up by Sherm Co.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Square Pizza Pod. In today's episode, you all are in for a real treat as Greg is in conversation with Dr. Shantoria Walker, who's the executive director at Education Power Ed. Education Power Ed is a nonprofit organization committed to developing an innovative model of culturally responsive, identity-centered schooling. In this episode, you will learn about Education Power Ed and Dr. Walker's newest book, Culture to the Max. She is one of three other co-authors. Culture to the Max presents readers with a powerful new set of culturally responsive teaching standards that can be used by teachers and administrators to counter institutionalized racism and white supremacy. The book offers an in-depth look into the practice and implementation of culturally responsive teaching that can inform curriculum development, teacher evaluation, and classroom and culture evaluation. As Dr. Walker dives deeper into the book, listeners will learn what inspired her to write the book, who it's for, how educators and families can work together to ensure equality in the classroom and school, and so much more. If you're interested in checking out Culture to the Max, the link will be included in the show notes. I hope you all enjoy this episode.
Dr. Walker, good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning. I'm so glad to be here.
How are you today?
I am great. It is Wednesday and it is starting off as a sunny day. So I am happy for that.
Well, we like that. And you're coming from Houston today. Is that right?
Houston, Texas. I've been here all my life, born and raised.
Okay.
I only went to college in Austin. So I've been in Texas forever.
Good for you. So I guess it'd be a bad question if I asked you if you liked it, but it appears you do like it since you've been there forever.
I love Houston. I love Houston. We got some, me and Texas got a different relationship, but I love Houston.
Houston is most days in Texas, right?
Good exactly. Or bad. Yeah.
I respect that and understand it. The only context I have about Houston, if I could, was I got to work there for a summer with Teach for America doing Institute. So we stayed at Rice and got to work at a middle school in Houston. But Houston has like two downtowns, like central business districts. Is that correct?
Yes. And huge. We always say it takes an hour to get from Houston to Houston because it's a lot of land. It's a lot of driving, a lot of traffic.
I was a urban planning major back in the day. So, right. Everything was talking about like congestion and walkability and, opposite urban sprawl. And then when I got to Houston, I was like, I think I just drove out of downtown, but I see another one. I've never been to a city before where there was like two. So introduced me to Texas.
Yes.
Well, we're excited to have you and get to know you even more, but also want to say, you know, we're going to talk more about the book, but saw a near and dear friend and the world famous Sharif El-Mekki wrote you a pretty nice review for the book. So curious about how you and Sharif got connected.
Yes. So I actually was a fellow with Teach Plus Texas and I was doing some advocacy work while they actually work with teachers in the classroom to advocate at the state capitol. And we crossed paths in one of the times that I was speaking at the state level. And I actually got an opportunity to go to his Black Male Educators Conference for my actual research. We met and from there, we've just been, in this same work. Yep. And then actually I worked for his company, his nonprofit, the Center for Black Educator Development this summer in rebuilding the Black teacher pipeline. I think his work is amazing. A lot of our work aligns and it's almost like branching off and continuing to talk about the amazing work that both organizations have done. So he's just kind of kept us near and dear. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's great. He, I think the conference is coming up again in October, November. I think we just push it on our social channel. So that will be something for our audience to check out. And Sharif is near and dear and does awesome work. And for those curious, he's episode number 52 on our podcast. So if you want to go back to learn more about Sharif and his great work, for those out there listening, after you listen to this episode, of course, with Dr. Walker, they'll give you two good back-to-back episodes to listen to, of course. And, you know, again, Dr. Walker, we're going to get more into the book in just a moment, but I think part of the book is really what you guys do day to day at Education Powered. Mm-hmm. So can you talk more, kind of more about like that work and the co-founders before we get into the book?
Definitely. So we are Education Powered. We've actually been around since 2017. We officially launched in 2019. David McDonald, Danielle Ross, Andre Ross. I knew David and Danielle when we went to the University of Texas at Austin. We graduated undergrad and then we kind of went our separate ways. And for whatever reason, we just came back. Came back together. They had this powerhouse company where they really wanted to push culture responsive resources training in Dallas ISD, where they were teaching, where they started. They just kind of were the teachers that were finding and looking for things for their students and trying to give them an education that they felt like they didn't have growing up. Same with me in Houston. I grew up in a traditional public school system, low income neighborhood, single parents at home. And so I knew, and I started teaching eighth grade English at an all boys preparatory academy. Mm-hmm. I was the first teacher that ever taught there that actually grew up in the community. Oh, wow. And so I brought like a unique perspective to those young boys. And so when we all collaborated and came back together, we just created this amazing social enterprise nonprofit where we do trainings. We've done trainings with culture responsiveness through large districts and small nonprofit organizations, and worked a little bit in the corporate world because we believe that, you know, culture is everything. Culture drives every single thing that you do. People, individuals, teachers, educators, and students need a sense of belonging, connectedness, need to feel a part of. And so we actually develop standards. Which is where the book is kind of coming from, like explicit standards on guidelines, mindset, behavior. And we believe that culture responsive teaching is embedded into four domains: social justice curricula, community partnerships, culture management, and authentic engagement. And so that's us. Like we everything is social media driven. We engage with about 20,000 plus educators. They engage with our brand daily, roughly. Yeah. And so, yeah, we just are a group of young Black educators, which that's another brand we also have that we are just pushing, you know, for all students to feel like they belong. And so that's basically the basis of Education Powered and how we got started and how we are where we are now.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing. I want to go back to something you said around being, I think, the first or one of the only teachers from Houston in that particular school that you taught at. And I know you said that for a reason. So can you explain why that's important in your experience and your context for the listening audience?
So when I first, I didn't know I was going to be a teacher, didn't know it was something that was in my blood, but I got an amazing opportunity to work with this district and where they paid for if you, a little long lines with Teach for America, but it wasn't Teach for America, where they pay for your master's, you teach with them 1 year, your second year, you become a full-time teacher. I didn't know that I was the first teacher to teach there at that particular school that grew up in the community. One of the things I first talked about when I first got there with the administrators is, hey, have y'all visited the local barbershops? There's a ranch right around the corner, right from this, you know, street. Like, did y'all visit that? And and they didn't know because they, you know, it wasn't nobody there that really knew the community like I knew the community. Everything was something that was embedded in me since I was in elementary. And so it became a thing where it was like, oh, wow, you know, we really can get a different perspective of these students, right? Because they actually come here too. I don't think it's negating the fact that teachers do work hard in the communities, in the schools, but I do see often a lot of teachers just go to the school and go home, right? Mm-hmm. We don't really get to learn about the community, where our kids come from, don't get the opportunity to really take them outside of the four, you know, walls in our classroom. And so that was something that was really important for me. And then the students responded. They appreciated that. So that was something that was a unique piece of me bringing that part to my teaching world in my first year. So it was really exciting.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing. And I definitely agree with all you said. I mean, there's something special about any person being homegrown, staying in their community to teach, knowing both like the pros and the cons and just the history of the neighborhood and the community, right? But also to your point, being able to take students and other teachers to the different assets and cultural spots in that community to lift up all the great things happening. I think thirdly, right, and you kind of alluded to it, it allows, it serves as inspiration to students for also from that community, right, to see what good people like yourself are doing. But then it also allows students to see you in a different light when you're doing something outside the school to build relationships and go deeper with them and their families as well.
And they feel like you see them, right? You yep. don't just know them within the context of the school, but now you know where they come from and you know their families, and you can actually see a different side of who they are beyond, you know, academics and test scores and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think we've seen in some part of our work, like home visits, right? Home visits stand up oftentimes through rigorous research is like one of the most powerful methods to connect with students and connect with families. And of course, you can do that even if you're not from a particular city. But to your point, going into the community and building relationships is, I'm really so far standing the test of time. So, you know, getting to the book, Culture of the Max, definitely excited to learn more and love that you guys wrote this book from what I've read so far, and really just excited to dig in. So I guess just to start, can you tell us, you know, what inspired you all? And I know you're a co-author of the book with the other co-founders of the organization you mentioned, but I'd love to just hear a little bit about the inspiration of the book.
So we, like I said, we developed the standards. My personal research is using culture responsive pedagogy to influence literacy achievement for Black male students. So based on what I told you about my home and teaching and all of that, I went ahead and realized I was doing something different, and I pursued my doctorate in that field and was able to really do some transformative things with that. So coming back together with David, Danielle, and Andre, we realized that the standards was there. The standards were there, the domains were there. We're using this in our trainings. We're actually showing educators there's a different experience, because what we feel like is that even today, culturally responsive teaching, a lot of people know of it, they're hearing of it, more people are using the phrase, but it's kind of turning into like a checkbox. Mm-hmm. Like it's not necessarily something that teachers are taking on to embody because of all the other demands that we have, you know. And then even with the COVID shutdown and all of that, you know, it's something that you kind of shy away from. It's like, okay, I did this. I celebrated Black History Month. I celebrated, you know, Mexican American History Month. I did culture responsive teaching. And we are here to say, we was like, that's not it. Right. Kids like us were in some sense felt like we were isolated for the curriculum. And I'm pretty sure there are many kids that you can identify in teaching where they just have a disconnect from the classroom. And so then we came together. We got the opportunity. I'm already published. And I have a journal article with Wiley Publishing. And so they came back around and asked us if we wanted to do a book, and, you know, just to get that in front of people with the work that we're doing. And so that was an opportunity that we saw was something that was amazing that we said we should just go after. And so with that, what we did was we came together and said, okay, it shouldn't be like any our teacher development sessions. Usually have a lot of, we build a lot of community, even if it's for 30 minutes or 90 minute sessions. So we felt like our book should feel the same way. It shouldn't feel like a textbook where it could probably get boring in the first few chapters. It shouldn't feel like you should just put it to the side in a minute. If you look even at the cover, we really took the time to take to really put some thought into what does culture to the max. When we say max, we mean turn it all the way up. Like, you know, whatever it means to you, if you can think of a stereo setting, turn it to the max, because that should be what drives the classroom. That should be what drives the hallways in school, the leadership development. That should be what drives everything, because unfortunately we have too many teachers. Of course, we're hearing about the teacher shortages, leaving the classrooms, not feeling a part of the system and the school and everything. And we need to figure out a way to keep those leaders, those teachers there, to become teacher leaders. And for specifically teachers of color, usually I did a paper with Sharif El Mekki, and with Teach Plus Texas, called To Be Who We Are, creating culturally Black schools for affirming cultures. We also did, if you listen, we could stay. I did that with Teach Plus Texas. And these are national reports that tell teachers and educators and school leaders and district leaders, this is how you keep and retain excellent, amazing, high quality teachers of color. And so that's really where we get with the book. We start to tell anecdotes, right? So we don't just give you the standards. We actually give you examples of what we actually did in our classroom. All of us have got amazing track records as teachers. Myself and Andre were voted Teacher of the Year in our first year of teaching. Everybody has everybody has high achievement scores. Like, our work has kind of spoke for itself. So we wanted to figure out a way to stamp it, to get it out there for more educators to feel like it's, and it's not just for Black students, it's for all students, right? Mm-hmm. It's for those students to feel a part. And it, what we found is most educators say, they knew it, but maybe I didn't think about it in this way. Okay, you guys are giving me a different way to think about what this means in my classroom. And so that's really the basis of the book.
It's incredible. And you know, the phrase, to your point, Dr. Walker, culturally responsive pedagogy can mean something to you, something to me, something different to the dude across the street, or the lady across the street. So you maybe give an example for the laymans out there that they don't have the doctor in front of their name. And I love a two-part, if you could, like, what does it look like when it's really working and what is it not? And I think sometimes, to your point, like, being really practical and creating clear examples allows people to understand what excellence looks like in this way in a classroom, and maybe what's kind of below expectation in a sense.
Exactly. So one of the things that we do think, when I explain culture responsive pedagogy in my own way, it could be arbitrary to others, but I say allowing your students to feel like they can bring their authentic selves into the classroom. Mm-hmm. They should not feel like they have to step into the doorway of your classroom and leave a cloak of themselves on the outside. They should be able to talk about their family, talk about their culture. They should be able to see themselves in the textbooks. They should be able to see themselves in the curriculum. They should be able to be all they can be, and then use that and those skills and those transferable skills to also use on the outside of the classroom. It also brings in joy and harmony, right? And what does it look like? It's when I say joy and harmony, when a student walks in, we have the posters, and we have the beautiful educational pieces and the quotes, but how is it representing your particular student in this classroom? Is your student from kindergarten, pre-K, all the way to 12th grade able to look around your classroom and say, I see myself? And if that's something we haven't really thought about, that's something that we have to get back to in culturally responsive pedagogy and teaching practice. Working with Sharif El Mekki and the Freedom Schools Literacy Academy, one of the things that he does that we talk about in our book is building harmony, culture management. We talk a lot about classroom management every year. We talk about routines, procedures, and systems. Mm-hmm. But how are you managing the culture in your classroom? And if you focus on managing the culture, you probably won't have to worry too much about the classroom management, because kids value it so much. So we would start, even with the Freedom Schools Literacy Academy, with something that brings the students together, right? In our book, we talk about a mantra. I used to do a mantra with my young boys to make them feel like, even if they had a bad morning, even if they don't feel like, you know, this is not for them, they don't feel like being at school, let's actually say a mantra that makes us feel like we can be a part of this together. We're in this together. And that seems so simple, but it builds so much character and so much community, and just taking the time to just check in, right? Some of the kids, it allows them to get pumped up. It allows them to be excited about the learning. And even when it gets tough, a mantra like this, what we found, I even found with this summer, mm-hmm. is that when things got tough, the kids went back to the mantra, because mm-hmm. it was so much more affirming to them. It showed them that they were valued within the classroom, and it created harmony for them. And so that was something that I think is amazing that we're really excited about. And that's just one example. We also talk about authentic engagement. Culture responsive pedagogy does not mean you take away the rigor and you take away the challenges. It actually means that you elevate it, right? You keep the kids up to a high expectation, but then you also let them know that there's a productive struggle. When you struggle, we're in this together as a community. And I'm not just going to leave you to struggle on your own, because usually when we struggle too much, there's a failure piece that kids are afraid to fail. Right. And so we do talk about that piece as well. Like, how important is it for us to actually take the time to do productive struggle and how to get that authentic engagement in there? So kids can feel like that they can, versus too many of our kids that look like me. And that look like sometimes our minority students, they continue to hit below the belt, below the standard, because it's just they kind of continue to fall through the cracks. What it doesn't look like is what I mentioned earlier. Just because we did a Black History Month celebration, just because we did, yes, these are a part of culture. These are part of culture responsive pedagogy, but it's not the only thing. Sometimes schools and districts and teachers think that it's okay, we did it, now we can move on. No, you have to do more. And then how are we being inclusive of more than just what we've learned since kindergarten? Everybody just about knows about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which is an honor and a respective hero for all of us. But then who else are we actually learning about and talking about in our classrooms?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, a few thoughts, if I could, like to your point around culture versus, I think I heard you say content, right? And how important culture and management is. I think the best advice I got as a first year teacher was essentially to use the first week. And these are high school, I call them babies. And of course they don't like that, but high school students.
I do too.
Good. We got that. But spend the first week going over routines and culture and systems before you even teach day one of content. And of course, many of my students were behind, but to this credit, the teacher that was mentoring me knew if you don't get those things tight, you could have the best lesson plan in the world, right? But if you don't have management tight, if the students don't believe in you, don't know that they can trust you, those things are going to go out the window come late December or late January. Like, getting those things tight the first few weeks really establishes how important it is to students.
Yes. And that was something that I really value as much as something that I practice as well. And David, Andre, and Danielle will talk about that as well, as much as we practice it. And we talk about that in the book too. And then beyond that, it's almost like one of the most important pieces of practicing culture responsive pedagogy is being aware of your bias. What bias do you bring to the classroom? And how could that impact either positively or negatively the actual content in the instruction, right? So within that first week, when my student is showing me who they are, when they're showing me their family, when they're showing me something that I haven't been exposed to in the first place, how am I reacting? And am I aware of how am I reacting? How am I including this? How am I making mental note of this? How am I feeling? Because if you are feeling uncomfortable and this is something that you feel like you can't do, then you do need to reach out and actually figure out, you know, what we could do as a community to continue, because it does happen. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes in culture responsiveness, we always think about the students, which is mostly driven towards the students, but we also have to think about the teachers. Cool. In order to do it. We have to be aware of the things that we bring. Even as a Black woman, I bring a bias as well with my personal experiences, and how am I checking that in order to ensure that I'm giving my students the best that they could and the most optimal learning experience.
And speaking of any biases we probably all have, but also moving into this new school year, right? We're recording this on August 10th. Some schools are already back in session. Some are gearing up soon. What's maybe one or two practical pieces of advice you'd give school leaders or those teachers as they're entering this new school year to begin to think about how they can make sure their classrooms or their schools are more culturally responsive?
I have a lot, but I will start with two.
Buy the book first. Give them some teasers.
Yeah. A few things, these are small, but when you allow your students to share their names, some people do not know or do not realize how powerful a name is. And so a teacher
share
their names.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. And so if I tell you that my name is Shantoria Walker And your response may be, oh, well, that's too hard, or your name is too difficult, or that's, you know, that is a piece of, beyond just bias, that is a piece of negating who the student is, right? Mm-hmm. So the time that we take to learn names, right, we should learn the student's names, you know, right? That's a goal for all educators, but learn how to say it right, learn the history of their names, allow students to share where their names have come from if they do know, and if they don't know, give them an activity to find out and allow them to bring that back to the class. That is one of the most impactful things that I have known. I've been actually coaching teachers. I've been a coach for the last 4 years. And last year after was our first full year back in person. And so we really had to take some time to build that back up, right? Because they've been in virtual learning for an entire year before that. And one of the things teachers would say, what do you mean the power of the name? I know my kid's name, but do you know their names? Mm-hmm. Do you know the history of their names? Did you allow them to share that? And it seems so simple, but it is a powerful piece.
Yeah.
The other piece that I think about is with talking about community partnerships. How are we including the community, which is our first domain that we talk about in the book? What type of community partnerships within the first week are we actually including? And I'm not just saying actually looking outside the windows and saying, okay, this is where that is, this is where that is, but how, I want to say, we did an activity to give a, to make it a little bit more, you know, sticky. We did an activity where within our first week of training last year, I think it was 2 years ago, I'm sorry, where we actually did a surveillance of the neighborhood, like a Google Maps type of thing as mm-hmm. teachers. And we actually analyzed what type of grocery stores are actually yep. around the school, like yep. what access do our kids have. And we found that the grocery stores, like, students would have to ride at least a 15-minute bus ride, right, and at least walk another 10 minutes just to get to their first primary grocery store. We realized that, and we did we called it a community walk. So we did a community walk within training, and then it took about a 6-month time, but we actually were able, once we realized that this was a need for the community, we actually partnered with the local food bank, Houston wow. Food Bank, and they showed up every Wednesday, twice a month, and they actually allow free groceries for the parents and the students to actually come from 3:30 to 6:30 twice a month to get groceries, whatever they needed, fresh food. And then we were able to use those as health and nutrition lessons within the school to talk about more nutritious and healthier choices. And so I would say those are the two biggest things to me within starting. And I've seen it done and we've done it, but really not just knowing where your students are, but what is happening in the community that could impact their learning. You know, it's more than them just showing up. They come with trauma, they come with baggage, they come with a lot, and we have to figure out how to affirm and value each and every one of those students from the moment that they walk in to the moment that they step out. And so those will be my two biggest things.
Yeah, I love that practicality that any educator listening right now can take away into this upcoming school year. Mm-hmm. And I know it's in the book, but also want to go deeper, because I think of any successful school or teacher, there's maybe the triangle of success, if I could just make that up right now on the spot. But there's usually like the educator in the school, the student, but then also the family, right? Yeah. And if we can get those three kind of parties on the same page, things usually work out really well. So curious what advice you'd offer. And I know some of this is in the book, with how educators can take this idea of culturally responsive pedagogy while they're working or just communicating with families on what to expect, or maybe how to reinforce these things at home as well.
Most definitely. We talk a lot about, you know, like we said, culture is everywhere. Culture responsive pedagogy is not just in the home. I mean, in the school, it's in the home, it's in corporate, it's in nonprofit, it's everywhere. So one of the things is that with our standards, implementing the biggest piece that you're talking about for us is the authentic engagement and the community partnerships and the culture management within the home. What we do is we use pieces of if students are talking about, so David McDonald writes the culture, the community partnerships parts. I apologize. So David is writing the community partnership part, right? Cool. Yep. And he talks about in the book where he actually has an open forum for parents, where he actually allows the parents to give feedback on the lessons. Now, this may be a little bit more, you know, for new teachers, it's going to take a minute to get comfortable with something like this, but it allows for open communication in an open class. Room to where the parents, sometimes we argue and we fuss about and we get frustrated as educators that we don't have enough parent involvement, but sometimes the parents don't really know what's going on. So what are we doing to open up our classroom to allow them to see what's happening? And then it changes the conversation at home to, and this is what he says in the book, to, hey, how did your school day go? To, hey, your teacher told me about this project that you guys are working on. Tell me a little bit about it, right? So now it enhances the home life and the home conversations. And it's a two-way street now. And that triangle that you speak of, you can see that it reaffirms and it restructures the foundation of the education to where students are not caught off guard. The parents feel disconnected. The students don't know that the parents don't know. The educators are begging for the parents to come in and they have to work. And it really talks about, David really talks about in his chapter how to kind of navigate that world, because we know we have a lot of respect for our parents and know that they have to work and they're doing a lot to care for their children. But how are we continuing to push this culture, responsive pedagogy and culture management piece, even at the home life, and then bringing them into making them feel a part of the classroom.
And it's great too, because when the parent asks that specific question, it puts some more friendly pressure on the student to give
so
more,
I have to give show better you answers I learned.
And just say like the day was good and keep it
right. Moving, right? Right. It takes it from the day, right. It was good. I did okay. Right. Now it's like, oh, I know what's going on. And it takes down a few of the inhibitions. What I found when I was actually teaching is I actually invited parents in, because in the English literacy world, I had for eighth grade boys, I had students that had gaps 3 and 4 years, students that read on the second and third grade level. I had an eighth grader who couldn't write his name. And come to find out when I was asking for parent involvement and just to get a little bit more structure and help with this particular student in the classroom, I found out that his father had a middle school education and his reading level wasn't where it should be to help his student, his child. And so I actually was able to invite the parent in, and we actually did literacy classes as a parent teacher student triangle. And it built so much confidence and it built so much capacity and it built to where they were learning together. And you would know that before that, the parent didn't, he was a little ashamed to come in because he didn't want to admit where his level of learning was. And so we were actually able to get down to the root of it. And I'm happy to say that the student actually graduated from high school. I was able to help him all those years back. His father was able to have some successful pieces in his life as well. So that is one of those pieces where it's like culture and culture responsive pedagogy goes further than just, like we say, a checkbox. It's really meaningful and it could be transformative in a lot of people's lives.
And Dr. Walker, this might be a tough question and that's a good antidote, but going deeper on like, how do we know if this is working? Like, what advice would you give to school leaders or educators? And we know test scores aren't a perfect measure. We know maybe not like attendance is a perfect measure, but curious, like from your work and experience, like what metrics do you look at or encourage people to look at to know if this work is working?
I love that. So it's not a perfect measure, but we can still go back to it, right? It's not separated, it's embedded. Okay. So if you do embed this piece, you will see an increase. And we have seen an increase in test scores. Mm-hmm. We have seen an increase in attendance because now the kids want to come to school. Now they feel like there's a sense of belonging in the school. There's a sense of, a piece of value with them in the school. And now they want to perform for you. So if you take these pieces, and we all four of us have seen this, we've worked with teachers, we also encourage open feedback, right? Which is most teachers, you know, it's a little bit different. It feels different. We have to actually kind of consult around what that means. But the same way that we get evaluative feedback from our district leaders and our school leaders, we should allow our students to evaluate us as well, right? You give them a student-friendly evaluative tool, and you do open communication. So beyond just the metrics of the state test, beyond just them attendance, beyond just them feeling like that they are part of the classroom, go ahead and do a few of those surveys within the school year to really allow students to give feedback on the lesson, how they're feeling, right? And have an open discussion on the results. If they make you feel some type of way, that is something that you have to check for yourself. And then that is where we kind of come in with the book and our consulting and our workshops and our training, where we actually dig deep into why this feels the way it feels. It should not be something that's a got you. It should also not be something where you feel like you're being demeaned or diminished as an educator. But you realize when you open those levels of communication and feedback with the students and allow them to give their two cents, basically, you know, one thing we talk about is the positionality of the teacher in the classroom in the book. And when we talk about that, we talk about, so even though I am the teacher, I am not the only expert in this classroom. There are all of you are experts. We just have to find your strength, right? And we have to figure out how you have a voice in this classroom. And I think those are the measurement pieces. You're going to see an increase. You just, it's not everything that we've seen an increase. Even in my personal piece that I talk about within my first year, the projected piece was 50% passing for those particular students because of their deficits. Unfortunately, sure. They had the highest, the group had the highest categorized as emotionally disturbed, a highest group in special education in the district, right? And so they were projected to only do 50%, and I knew I had a tough job, and they scored an 84% passing and a 14% commended within my first year. And that was one where it's like, oh, okay, it was more than just the teaching piece. It was the inclusive piece. It was the value piece. It was the affirming piece. It was the culturally responsive piece, right? And then it was the feedback piece. How am I actually taking that and creating a two-way street for me and my student to make them feel like this is something that they can do? Because too often they hear that they can't. And that's a little sad for our babies.
So I'm hearing you say educators shouldn't be, you know, they shouldn't feel overwhelmed that the implementing this sort of work comes with brand new metrics and other eval things. If nothing else, it will only help support and increase and move the needle on the ways they're already being evaluated.
Exactly. It's not something else to do. It is what to do, right? It is something that will enhance your teaching and your perspective. It will open up some avenues that you didn't know you had. A lot of times that is what happens. It's like, I'm teaching and I'm doing culture responsiveness. What we're saying is that the practice is the teaching. It is the standard. It is the way to do it. And then at the end, you will see the evaluative pieces that will increase. And then even with our standards, the way that we actually created them are just like state standards or school standards. You can actually develop them, break them down into objectives, lessons. You can have, we encourage teachers to do peer-to-peer feedback. So not only getting feedback from their school leaders, but also, you know, teachers evaluating teachers and in a good way, right? Building that community to where it doesn't feel like it's, like I keep saying, I gotcha. It should not feel like that. It should feel like iron sharpens iron, and we're all in this together to push this learning for our kiddos.
I like that. This is great. We're going to get you out of here on a few hopefully fun and rapid fire questions. First one, what can our audience do to support you and your work?
Yes. One thing you can do is follow us. Our social media, our actual website is educationpowered.org. That's ED at the end. Our social media channels are on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter. We have a few things that are going on currently. We have the first 25 people who read the book and give us a review on any platform that you would feel like. We are looking for honest feedback, just like the same way we practice what we preach. So tell us what you thought about the book. Yeah. You know, tell us what you thought about the book, leave us a review, and then we're actually doing free t-shirts on our website. If you message us through Instagram and DM us and tell us that you've left a review, we would like to see the review after you've read the book, and you will actually get a free t-shirt from us, because we also do power gear. That's one of our biggest things. We also have some pretty big events coming up in Houston and Dallas as well. And so if you're in the Texas area, you will see us. If not, just support. And lastly, we are also doing South by Southwest. So we're trying to for next year in Texas. So we're going to put up our book pieces and get ready to actually put it out so people can vote on it. So we can be a part of South by Southwest next year. So those are three huge things that we can do for support.
That's great. We've had a few guests from Dallas on the podcast. And so we have some Dallas friends. So we'll make sure we share this specifically with them.
Yes.
What musical artist are you listening to right now?
Toby Nwigwe. He is a Houston-based artist. He is conscious-minded. He talks about the community and everything that I talk about. He's from actually the A-Leaf area, which is south side. I'm from the north side of Houston, but he is one of my biggest artists right now, just because I just feel like his music embodies the work that we talk about. It's something I love.
And what type of music does he perform?
It's hip-hop and rap.
Cool. Last question. What does square pizza remind you of, Dr. Walker?
That is a good question. What does square pizza remind me of? Not being able to fit in the box. Something that is, you know how they say a square peg in a round hole? I think that this podcast and the opportunity that you've given us and what we've done in equitable, creating an equitable society and education is something that's different. And I feel like Square Pizza is the embodiment of that, not being put in a box, doing something different, stepping out of it. We're not a square peg in a round hole, right? So we're doing what we have to do to actually get this work out. And I appreciate you guys having us on for that.
I love that. Thank you. Thanks so much for all you do. So happy to have you on the podcast. Definitely excited to check out the book and see all the success from afar you all are going to have.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
Of course. Thanks, Dr. Walker.
Thanks so much for checking out the Square Pizza Pod, making a few selfish requests. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps spread the word about the podcast, and share this with a friend. We appreciate it. Thanks.